You're listening to IsraelScene.com.
And you're listening to IsraelScene.com.
Listening to IsraelScene.com.
Seen through the eyes of Steve, that's myself.
And you're on.
Two characters passionate about everything that happens in Israel.
IsraelScene.com.
And you're listening to IsraelScene.com. I'm Steve.
And this is Yoram.
And we have a special program today. We're going to discuss the current events as they happen. Today is Monday, July 17th. We're broadcasting right now from Tel Aviv in the early afternoon. And hopefully you will be getting to hear this in just a short time after this initial broadcast. So where do we begin, Yoram?
Well, I think we begin somewhere around 1937 or 1936, or maybe it was 1934. And then we pick it up again in 1938 and 1941, where we learn that appeasement is a loser, that when we perceive people about to do evil, we need to set aside all of our sensitivities and all of our intellectualizing and get to destroying them or blocking them or taking them very seriously, because if we don't, we really end up paying a very high price. Even though a lot of the instincts, the things people are hoping will be the result of their behavior, maybe well, you know, good ideas and well thought and people wanting for the best, but wanting and hoping and even praying sometimes is not enough. There are times when it requires actual action to prevent great mayhem, to prevent great inhumanity. Sometimes a little inhumanity needs to be expressed.
As we know, that happened in World War II, the decision was to bomb Hiroshima and Nagasaki, killing millions. But at the same time, the projection was, let's assume that everybody is honest in their response, that ultimately save the lives of millions of more people if they continued a protracted war with Japan. And certainly that ended it. Tragically, but it ended it.
Let me try and correct a little bit, Steve. I don't think the atomic bomb in Hiroshima and Nagasaki together killed millions, plural. I think it killed hundreds of thousands, plural.
Ah, okay. It's going to be corrected.
The potential casualties from a land invasion of the Japanese mainland was indeed millions, and it was women and children and men and Americans and Japanese and Australians and the prisoners of war and on it was a really a very brave move on the part of Harry Truman to make that decision, difficult as it was and as much bad vibes as he collected as a result over the years. But I think the alternative would have been far worse, although it would have looked better because it would have looked like a normal war and people are sort of used to normal war. And here we have the same story. I mean, it's years now that we've heard from the military and from military intelligence and that Hezbollah has collected the first hundreds and then thousands and then tens of thousands of rockets aimed at Israel. And the next day you don't hear about it. The next day there's, you know, other news, and it sort of disappears in the consciousness. And somehow I have this feeling that if on the first day that military intelligence knew that Iranian rockets were being landed in Damascus and being transshipped to Lebanon, that was the day to have acted. That was the day to have blown them up the first time. And that would have saved all of us, including the Lebanese, a lot of bad times and difficulty.
I also agree. I think that for some unknown reason we confuse compassion with excess, and I think that there's a real serious problem here, and I think we're doing the nasty, dirty work that the rest of the world needs to get done in terms of dealing with terrorism. We have no choice, I think, and I think we have to destroy. You know, it's interesting. We have to destroy the infrastructure. There's no doubt. And we're doing that in Gaza, I think, with Hamas. And I certainly, from my perspective, I think also we have no choice but to do it especially in Lebanon with Hezbollah, especially with all of the armor that they have and some of it, God knows what else they have in store. I think it has to be crushed. I think we have no choice. I think the rest of the world really, including many Arab countries, would like nothing more for us to do that for them, for ourselves and for them. The question is, will we succeed? That's an open-ended question that none of us really know.
And fluttering in the background, Steve, don't forget, is the Iranian nuclear story, where also I think the world would be very satisfied if we would take the brunt and we would take the blame and we would make the moves.
I think this is a test right now, in fact, right here in Lebanon and in Gaza. I think this is a real test for Iran's strength and Syria's direct involvement. And I think that I don't think we stand a chance. Yesterday, in fact, I listened to Barack, not my favorite politician, but I listened to him. I don't know where he was on, BBC, CNN, Sky News, one of those networks. And they asked him a question about North Korea and whether the G8 could handle North Korea and Iran. And he didn't laugh, but he was in the process of almost laughing. He says, they can't even handle Hezbollah. How in God's name are they going to handle North Korea and Iran? And in fact, until they handle Hezbollah, that Iran will never listen and North Korea will never listen because they're not moved by words. It's action that they understand. Hamas understands action. Hezbollah understands action. Iran understands action, and so does Syria.
And so do we.
And so do we.
I mean, we heard a lot of words from Hezbollah over the years, and finally they acted, and suddenly somebody woke up and said, you know, we can't let this just continue. And that's what this war is currently about. All of us. I mean, it's not only some vague them who only understand force. It's all of us. That's how you know that with your children. There were times when you explained to them and you talked to them and you pleaded with them and you went through all the changes possible, and then you just had to use your physical force in order to move them from place A to place B because they needed to be moved. And we're all like that. I mean, that's part of our humanness, or it's part of the animal part of our humanness. We all recognize and respect force. We all recognize and respect pain. It's not just the other who does that. It's all of us. That's part of the human wiring, for better or for worse. That's what we have to deal with.
Well, I'm a little amazed at how, at least in the media, I have no idea what everybody's thinking, but at least in the media, this obsession with disproportionate response. So that means that if only 10 die on the Israeli side from Katyushas, that only 10 should die on the other side. This quantitative balance, which is coming out of this old way of thinking, I feel, you know, where there has to be some scientific, mathematical equation to make everything fair and equal. Nothing's fair and nothing's equal in war. War stinks. People get hurt. Innocent people get hurt. Then again, I'm not even sure what's innocent anymore. I mean, we're all here, they're all there, and, you know, you have a situation where you have a group of people who have really essentially been undermining a sovereign state and threatening us and had directly threatened us with all the rocket attacks and so forth, Katyusha attacks, and we respond, and we want to go in and clean them out, get the cancer out of Lebanon, if we can do that, to help us and, obviously, Lebanese and God knows who else. And we're all of a sudden in the media being accused of, well, I mean, you know, you've targeted this place, but there's been X amount of people killed in the process. This is war. And the job has to be done. We don't go after civilians. Every Katyusha that lands in Israel is directly directed at civilians, men, women, and children. When we go in and we bomb because we see it as a strategic military situation and it has to be done. A lot of where Hezbollah has their military is in the middle of civilian populations. That's what they do. So does Hamas. So when what do you have to do? You send out leaflets 24 hours in advance. Tell people, hey, listen, leave your area. Because wherever there is a terrorist, a Hezbollah, we're going to kill them. We're going to destroy the infrastructure. I mean, I don't know how much more you can tell people. This is war. It's not fair that they have to leave. There's no choice if we're to eradicate this scourge in our midst. And I don't understand that kind of thinking, the unwillingness to really come to terms with the reality on the ground.
Well, I think this is part of all of our life processes and the way we live our lives. We all try and avoid difficulty, and we all try and avoid you know, going to the doctor to hear bad news if we think that that's what we're going to hear. We always prefer to put off some kind of medical procedure that might be uncomfortable, even though the sooner it takes place, potentially the longer we will remain healthy.
Look, I understand the fear is a motivating factor in avoidance. I mean, that's clear, but there is a moment in time when we have to do what's right. I mean, let's go even to Torah for a second, the Old Testament, for it clearly states in many instances, when you see your enemy, your job is to destroy it. And if you have the compassion, what you think is the right compassion, not to destroy them, they're ultimately grow again and they're going to come back and hit you twice as hard. And maybe you won't survive with that, which we have seen manifest in the stories in the Torah. It's the stories in Asia, the same thing with Arjuna and Krishna, the same thing. You know, that your job, you have a job, you know what it has to do. Ultimately, it's in the best interest of everybody. And yet, for some reason, at least this point in time, terror doesn't seem to manufacture a situation where the powers that be in the world can clearly see them and clearly see that it's a cancer and that it has to be eradicated. Otherwise, there's always going to be terror and ultimately the threat in the entire world, because the toys that they're playing with in Iran affects the entire world. It's no longer regional. It's no longer local. It's global. And until we come to terms with that, we have a serious problem on our hands.
Well, we do have a serious problem on our hands. I think that's very clear. We here are sort of, again, the canary in the mine when it comes to that. And we're most directly affected, and we're the loudest who scream about it. We is not only you and I, Steve. We is Israel and people who are close to Israel and the Jewish people who are connected to Israel. We're the ones who make the most noise, because we're most directly affected, frankly. And around us, people, would rather go fishing. You know, there are other important things like watching the Mundial or whatever it happens to be, and we're spoiling the party. I mean, we've been doing this now for almost, you know, 3,000 years, spoiling the party and telling people that there's another level of reality that it would be wise to relate to and to express and to experience when people just want to party. And people are going to party, you know, right out through, you know, right to the end. And part of the reason that the approach of the end has to do with this partying business, rather than people taking seriously the issues, whether they're global warming or whether they're the terrorism or whether they're the inhumanity in its various forms that are being expressed, and the exploitation of people and the exploitation of the earth and the exploitation, you know, of everything that can come to hand as long as you get to have your goodies. It's across the board.
So we're the wake-up call for the whole world?
Always.
Always.
That's part of our task. That's part of, in a sense, our pride. And that's part of the reason they hate us. And it's very obvious. I mean, I don't like people who wake me up. This morning I had a dog in my yard, and if I could have killed him, I'd have killed him. I don't like it. I was, you know, it was early, and I was pleasantly and happily curled up in the sleep. And this animal, this being comes along and wakes me up. Nobody wants to be awoke. Everybody wants to be comfortable and asleep and drunk and, you know, and laid back and all those other terms and ideas that are so prevalent. And we come along and we rock the boat and we wake people up and we yell and scream and we draw the fire that creates the large-scale mess like we did in Europe in the 30s. That really woke everybody up, and it really was to a degree our fault. It was us and our ideas and our ideals that brought about that focused that negative energy, and that fine focused it to the point like where you take a magnifying glass and you set it before the sun and a piece of paper and you make the piece of paper, you know, go into fire. And that's who we are, and that's why they've always disliked us, and that's why they will continue to dislike us. And we have to accept that and understand that and work from that understanding and not suddenly be surprised. Oh, my God, look at that. They don't like us. They're angry at us. Well, of course. That's the way the system works. Now, the interesting thing, Steve, is that this time, Dafka, according to what I've read about what's coming going out of the G8 in St. Petersburg, We're not getting the
condemnation,
the big stick.
Right?
And that's a surprise of its own. And what's behind that, or in front of it, or around it? You know what? Then what ends up being is that when they don't come and beat on us, we get suspicious. Why aren't they hitting us, right? Why aren't they condemning us?
I think, though, it's pretty clear here, though.
What's the conspiracy here?
I think it's pretty clear here, though, that they all recognize. I mean, it was so clear what took place, that there was, that clearly there was an attack from a sovereign nation on another sovereign nation, and the terrorists, and the fact that the connections between Syria and Iran is so clear, that at this point, they really, I mean, I thought Bush said it really well in a piece that was not supposed to be aired. And he, at the very end of a meeting with Blair, sitting down with Blair, says, I'm tired of Hezbollah shit. And that it's Syria tomorrow, with one phone call, could end this whole thing. And it's got to be done. This is not responsible. And I thought it was like a little, you get a little back, just by chance, we got a little back door into that world of leaders speaking with each other. And then Blair, most of it wasn't audible, I guess, but Blair did say, yeah, I know, that's why we really got to do something, but it's some kind of international force that has some teeth into it. So, listen, we have an opportunity right now to go to the Galil with person we know, Moti Schwartz, and he's in Shemshit in the Galil, and get a report from him as to what's taking place. So why don't we do that right now?
Good idea.
Okay. Are the sirens going on right now?
Yeah.
So we're listening to, we're speaking with Moti Schwartz, who's up in the Galil, or the Galilee, and as we're ready to interview him to find out what's going on, sirens are now going off. So Moti, can you share with us what's happening up there?
Actually, yeah, there's a siren over here, and we were called to go to the shelters. I'm here in a sheet, which is in a Tzomet HaMovil, not far from Tivon, Yokneam, and I'm at home with my daughter, and we were called to go down to the shelter, so to a protected room. And
yeah,
we are on our way.
And the sirens are on now, right? Because we can hear it in the background right now. Go ahead.
I'm going outside. Hold on.
Oh, we got it. Good. We got him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And all over there, yeah?
Yeah, we can hear it.
You heard boom?
Yeah.
You heard boom?
No, I missed her. I didn't hear. All right.
So how's the feeling up there, Moti?
Well, it's really something that you don't know where it's going to come from. Amit, let's go home.
Hello,
Amit, it can come any morning. Well, it's kind of it's a strange feeling. I can't say there is a fear. Even my 15 years old daughter, does not afraid. Actually, she went out to see where it's coming from, like a basketball game. I don't know. We can.
Have you spoken to any of your neighbors or anybody around the area, and how they're. I know you never get used to it, but it's not the first time for us, so.
No, everybody's taking it differently. There's some people I can say, and this is happened in every city that has been bombed. Some of the people don't want to deal with it and move away, take their family and go to another city, another place. There's some people, like myself, say that, we are going, this is our home, here we, this is where we're going to stay. We're staying here. We are not feeling any fear or anything, and, we're just trying, watching ourselves and continue with our normal life as much as possible.
Yeah, and you have a son in the army right now too, don't you?
Yeah, I have a son in the army. He's not far from Jenin, doing patrols and things like that. And actually, right now, I think it's safer for us to be with him than to be here.
It's strange, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, huh?
So, listen, Moti, I want to thank you very much. And we'll hopefully maybe we can get back to you again soon.
All right.
Thanks.
Take care.
Okay, bye.
So that was Moti Schwartz from Shimshit in the Galilee. By chance, we caught him just as we had some sirens for a warning of incoming Katushot. So where are we with all of this now?
Well, I'll tell you, Steve, the interview with Moti reminded me very strongly of the experience during the encounter with Saddam Hussein's missiles a few years ago when they were flying into Tel Aviv and also into Haifa and into various parts of Israel. The sound of the sirens, there's something about it that really is like, you know, scratching your nails on the chalkboard of your soul. Pardon me for being so, I don't even know what to call it. It's like a little overdone, but that's really what it's like.
No, totally. I understand. I had it when we were living on Kibbutz Gesha Haziv during the 80s, just before the Lebanese War, and Katushits were raining on Gesha Haziv, which they're raining on again. Three little kids in a safety room in the apartment on the kibbutz, and then all of a sudden, these Katushits are falling, and you just grab your kids and you. We had like a little run. We ran to the shelters, and we wound up in there for 2 weeks. Some of the kids were afraid to leave after a while. They were so frightened. But I understand that feeling, especially when the sirens go off. It is eerie.
That's the other word, of course. I think we need to, I think all of us, including the listeners and ourselves, to clarify and remember what this idea about the disproportionate response, the disproportionality in this war is. Part of the disproportionality has to do with that we're facing an enemy that not only has no compunctions, but actually as part of its philosophy, believes in hiding behind the civilian population. Partly that comes from Mao Tse-tung's the little red book and before, where he talked about how the guerrilla, the revolutionary, swims in the sea of the people, and that's how he defends himself by just melting into the community, so that those who are attempting to suppress him cannot find him or see him from the mass of people around him. And this is also a disproportionate element in this war between the Hezbollah and ourselves, and between the Hamas and ourselves. And with Hezbollah, we have another very unique occurrence, which is that Hezbollah is also hiding behind the sovereignty of the supposedly independent state of Lebanon. This is really one of the other things that we've allowed to them to get away with for the last since we pulled out of Lebanon.
I know that, and that's the that for me is the disgrace of the so-called United Nations, because it was clear they had the. They made a resolution to that effect, and it was all understood that the Lebanese would take responsibility for their territory, bring the Lebanese army down south, and either disarm or neutralize Hezbollah. And, of course, none of that was done. We left Lebanon. They saw it as a victory, which is typical in this part of the world, and thought now that they had a license now to at will, you know, send over Katushot, which they have consistently done for the past X amount of years, 4 years or whatever since we got out. But this has been a disaster, and I think at this point, Lebanon has to take responsibility, even though some claim they don't have the power. With the help of the United Nations, with the help of the rest of Europe, somehow they must, with help, take responsibility and disarm Hezbollah, whatever will be left of them after we get through.
That is definitely another part of the equation that we have we've lost. We've ignored it. We've walked away from it. We and the rest of the world. I mean, the United Nations had a very strong part in our leaving Lebanon. They came out with their survey crews and their GPS systems, and in some places we moved the fence 4 or 5 feet, And in some places, the fence was moved 4 or 5 yards. In other places, it was moved 4 or 5 centimeters in order to validate and to complete the legal withdrawal from Lebanon to the last inch, to the last centimeter. And the idea being that that's it. We're out. And now it's a sovereign country sitting across the border from another sovereign country. And in that context, if the other sovereign country, being not us, being Lebanon, violates our sovereignty, then we have every right in the book to respond strongly to their violation of our sovereignty, the same as if we were to violate their sovereignty. And we had several soldiers kidnapped, I don't remember, this number of years ago. They were returned to us dead. It turns out that the United Nations units along the border who were there to verify the neutrality of the border and the peacefulness of the border aided the Hezbollah people who grabbed these soldiers and who later murdered them.
Total disgrace.
It's beyond a disgrace. It's really the disintegration of the international, the great attempt at an international system for regulating the behavior of nations and of people.
Usually it's effective when you have nations have a sense of responsibility to the rest of the international community. But it doesn't work when you have terrorists. It just doesn't work. I mean, by the nature of who they are, they're defying all international law, so to speak, for their own particular ends. But as Netanyahu said, how can you possibly talk about negotiations when they receive their instructions from God and God tells them that to kill you? So who are you negotiating with? Where is the negotiation? Where's their compromise? I mean, it was well said. In this mode, I'd like to invite all our listeners to please send us some questions, send us your opinions, your comments to radio@israelscene.com. We're more than happy to read them on the air. And if you don't agree with us, please, we're interested in hearing your comments regardless where you sit on this issue. So I think we're going to wrap this one up.
One other thing I would like to mention.
Not quite.
Gotcha. And that is that I've read in my reading in the last several days over the weekend, it seems that many people in the Israeli left who were urging us to leave Lebanon over the years, the group of the Four Mothers and various parts of the political left, all seem to understand that we can no longer just ignore what's happening and that we must respond, and that we must respond militarily and we must respond strongly. I have a feeling that the left that's outside of Israel, that bears far less basically no responsibility, and bears no consequences for what happens here, are still dragging along the old paradigm that Israel is to blame for whatever happens. And I think that hopefully that left is also in a shrinking mode, because it is a destructive left. It is a left that is responsible for a lot of bloodshed and for a lot of misery, even though its intentions are good. Even though I think that's how you can tell the road to hell.
Hell, yes.
Is that there's all these long line of good intentions that point in that direction
here and
eventually bring you there.
Yeah, here and in America, and I think before we were on Lerner's website. And again, instead of addressing the issue as it is, everybody's in denial, and everybody's talking about how he is totally in total compassion and understanding for the suffering of the world. I mean, I think in all due respect, maybe he may be an incarnation of JC. That's harsh. Or maybe not. But we rejected it then.
He's also one of those nice Jewish boys.
Goodness, if it was be so easy, so easy.
Now I'll let you sign us off.
So we were almost live today, Monday, In Tel Aviv. And we, again, please send us any comments or any messages you may have to radio at israelscene.com. We appreciate your support, and we look forward to hearing from you real soon. We also, just to let you know, we have some more programs that we've recorded with some very interesting people that we'll be putting up online right after we put this this broadcast to. So,
let me mention the one that I think would be particularly interesting with Yossi Klein Halevi, the journalist. He's written for the Jerusalem Post and the Jerusalem Report, the Jerusalem Post and the Jerusalem Report. He's now the Israel correspondent for the New Republic, and we interviewed him literally the day before this whole the northern explosion, and when the topic of the day was the southern explosion, our engagement in Gaza. There's never a dull moment, and that's one of the problems here, is that it's very hard, and not only for us as just ordinary civilians, but for people in the leadership positions here too, it's very difficult. Part of the difficulty has to do with keeping up with so much going on. I mean, just a few days ago, the news broadcasts all opened with items concerning the president of the state, Moshe Katsav, and supposedly, all kinds of rumors and accusations regarding his behavior, and that was like what everybody wanted to know and what everybody thought was really important. And then, boom, all of a sudden we had the involvement in Gaza, and then it seems like a few hours later we have this really expansive, developing situation in Lebanon. And in the meantime, people are just trying to get along.
And with that, we'll see you soon. I'm Steve.
And this is Yoram.
And you're listening to IsraelScene.com.
Thank you.